Let's turn in our Bibles to the book of Job in chapter 13. I'm sure we are all reasonably familiar with this Old Testament saint. Nevertheless, let's just remind ourselves of some facts concerning him and what this book is about. So the scholars tell us that Job probably lived around about the time of Abraham, and he comes to us very highly commended by God. We're told in the first chapter that he is blameless, that he's upright, that he fears God and he shuns evil. We see that he offers sacrifices on behalf of his children, all adult children, just in case they sin. Not even knowing whether or not they have sinned, but just in case they have sinned. And he is presented to us as a very wealthy and successful man. If you go through the livestock that he has of donkeys and sheep and camels, it runs into the thousands. He's blessed with 10 children. I think it's 7 sons and 3 daughters. And he is described to us as a man without equal, a man who is blessed, a man who was noted for wisdom and reputation. He was one of the elders who would sit at the city gates in order to judge over matters. So he was a man of good reputation, wisdom, and fair assessment. And he is presented to us really as this very godly, very successful man. Perhaps he prospered in business. He was wise. He was really above reproach. And of course, he's famous for the fact that he suffered terribly. He suffered terribly by way of satanic attack. In chapters 1 and 2, we're presented with a really unusual scenario, I guess, of Satan coming before God. And the picture we have is of Satan sort of going to and fro over the earth, looking to cause trouble. And God actually draws Job to Satan's attention. "Have you considered my servant Job?" And Satan's response is basically that, "Well, Job worships you, he honours you, because you have hedged him in. You've given to him a blessed life, you've given to him so much. But if those blessings are removed and Job tastes another side to life, then you will find no longer will he be a man who praises and lives before you with honour." And of course, God effectively gives Satan free charge to afflict Job with some qualifications. Of course, he's not allowed to take Job's life, and the afflictions come in two waves. To begin with, Job loses his livestock, property is ruined, the servants are killed, and he loses all of his children. That was the first wave of affliction, and Job remains upright, he doesn't curse God, and God then permits Satan to have another wave of attack, and on the second wave, Job is covered in boils from the crown of his head to the soles of his feet. And he still doesn't curse God. Then his three friends turn up, Eliphaz, Bildad and Zophar. And they are shocked at what they find. I mean, he's unrecognisable. He doesn't look like the old Job. Such is his physical disfigurement as a consequence of these boils. And to begin with, they're very sympathetic. Their hearts bleed for their friend, but they then also turn very quickly on him. And in their thinking, the way they understand the world to work is that God is holy and he punishes wickedness. Okay, he's a righteous God and he must punish wickedness. And that leads them to one conclusion. Okay, Job has lived a certain manner in front of people. He's appeared to be a certain thing, but obviously behind the scenes, he's a wicked man, because otherwise these things would not have happened to him. This obviously is a consequence of his hypocrisy, and they accuse him of hypocrisy. And there's a sense in which we can say much of what they say, that the friends say, has substance to it. It's true. God blesses righteousness and he punishes wickedness. But the problem with their thinking is that there's an inflexibility to it. It's a rigid theology that has no exception. Because the scriptures also teach us over and over again, by way of example, that the righteous do suffer. They suffer inexplicably without reason. We don't always know why the righteous suffer, but they do suffer. And it's this rigid theology that they sort of can't see beyond certain kind of ideas. What follows then, for the most part of the book, are a series of conversations between these three friends and Job. And there's three cycles. So Job, they speak to Job, and he addresses each one individually. So we have the first cycle, 1, 2, 3, and then there's a second cycle, and there's a third cycle. So it's Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. At the end of the third cycle, Zophar doesn't speak, strangely enough, but in steps this very mysterious figure called Elihu. And after that, then God steps into the situation, and God rebukes the friends because they are quite wrong in how they've applied their thinking to Job. God rebukes Job himself because some of the things Job also says were not quite right. And then God vindicates Job at the end. Now, in these discussions between Job and the friends, there are so many rich statements that we could consider. And there's a big part of me would like to preach through this book because I really like it. And for those of you who are around sort of 5 or 6 years ago, we actually did it as a midweek Bible study. But I must say, in terms of preaching through it, it also intimidates me because there's a lot of material there. Nevertheless, there are some wonderful statements, some wonderful portions and sections and just verses worth considering. And I want to consider two verses this evening, and one aspect of these verses is really, really well known. So it's Job chapter 13, verses 15 and 16. And the first part of verse 15 is very well known. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Even so, I will defend my own ways before him. He also shall be my salvation, for a hypocrite could not come before him. Now, I mentioned before that there are three cycles. This is the end of the third cycle. This is Job speaking to Zophar, addressing Zophar when he says this. And what I want to show us from these two verses is basically two pictures concerning Job. Firstly, Job is a picture of mature faith. And secondly, Job is a picture of a good conscience. Now, I want to put to you this evening that these two things are critical to healthy Christian living. Mature faith and a good conscience. So let's note firstly then, Job, a picture of mature faith. What we see here and we see elsewhere so clearly put before us is the fact that Job understands the sovereignty of God. He accepts the sovereignty of God. Job says in this very famous affirmation, though he slay me, though God slays me. And it's all very well speaking of the sovereignty of God, as we're so apt to do, when life is well and things are going in a pleasant way. We like to speak of God's sovereignty in terms of his power and his wisdom and his love and his mercy. But what about when things are not going so well and life isn't pleasant and things are not falling into place as we would like? What about when pain enters the picture and the pain is acute? So many Christians become disillusioned when life becomes difficult. Where is God is a common question. You go on all the blogs and the websites and the podcasts, and this is a question that is frequently addressed. Suffering Christians, where is God? And it's almost as though God has abandoned them, or in some way he has deceived them. It's as though Christians feel that they have a right to things falling into place and everything going well. And when things don't go well, where's God? Has he abandoned me? Has he deceived me? He's not doing what I expected him to do. And there's also a similar kind of response to this, though a bit different, and that is to distance God from what is happening. He's removed from the pain as though he has no part to play in it whatsoever. And there are many Christians who speak about God merely allowing things to happen. And it's true to say on one level, God does allow things to happen. But as we can see from the account here, it's actually God who is behind Job's affliction. God used Satan, as it were, and Satan also used means. The means of the bandits and the elements are one part of the picture, and behind them there is Satan. But who lies behind Satan? It's the sovereign God. There's a sense in which we can say, God kind of stirred Satan up. Have you considered my servant Job? God was not distant and far removed from what was taking place. He's at the heart of it. And a lot of Christians speak purely of God allowing things. And it conveys the idea that Satan is kind of just doing what he wants. He's fulfilling his own will and purpose, and God has his arms folded and he's just watching it take place. And that's not how the world works. Job succumbs to neither of these views. Job knows who is running the show. At the end of chapter 1, so he's lost his property, his animals have been taken away, the servants are dead, and his 10 children are dead. And he says this at the end of chapter 1, verses 20 and 21. Then Job arose, tore his clothes, shaved his head, and fell to the ground and worshipped, and he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away." It's not the bandits, it's not the elements, it's not Satan. The Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And then in chapter 2, at the end of chapter 2, or toward the end of chapter 2, he's contrasted with his wife. And this is after the second wave of attack, when he's covered in sores. And he's an absolute mess, he's unrecognizable, and he's in acute pain. Chapter 2, verses 9 and 10, then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." In other words, why don't you alleviate yourself of all of this suffering? If you curse him, he'll just take you out. He'll kill you. And then it'll end for you. Curse God and die. Why continue suffering? But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Shall we not accept adversity from the hand of God? He recognizes that the ultimate cause of the sores and the loss of servants and property and children is ultimately the Lord. It's the Lord. Now, when it comes to Job's wife, I'm not certain that she was an unbeliever, as many of the commentators would have us to believe. She may have simply been a woman overcome with grief and at the end of herself. And one thing that's apparent in the Bible when we read through it, when God's people are severely afflicted, they don't always respond well. Some of them do silly things, some of them say silly things, and there are many examples. Abraham jeopardized the welfare of his wife by lying. David feigned madness before the king. We see that Peter, under duress, denied that he knew Jesus Christ. He did the unthinkable, said he would never do it. But he did, not once, but three times. There was no actual even threat to his life. But such was his anxiety and his sense of fear on the occasion, he couldn't stand up to it. And he wanted nothing to do with Jesus, and sort of at that point washed his hands. I do not know who this man is. He began to curse and swear. God's people under duress don't always respond well. And I think that that's quite possibly the case with Job's wife. And perhaps what we see with her and with Job are two pictures. A picture of immature faith and a picture of mature faith. Immature faith on the part of the wife. Faith with shallow roots. Faith without much understanding. Faith without much substance to it. And on the other hand, faith which was mature, healthy and growing. Faith which had deep roots and was grounded in a good understanding of who God is. Faith, when buffeted, it did not blow over. Now, importantly, when it comes to Job and this picture of mature faith, I want us to note that it goes beyond just a stoic kind of acknowledgement that God is sovereign. Job's wife acknowledges that God is sovereign. Job's wife acknowledges that God's hand is involved in this situation. But unlike his wife, Job remains a worshipper of God. And I tend to think we have a woman here who would worship God and bless God when she was enjoying those meals with her children, enjoying all of the blessings and all of the provision, but now that things have gone wrong, no longer is she praising and worshipping, but she's cursing. But Job, on the other hand, he still worships. We go back into chapter 1, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He's still worthy of my worship. As painful as this situation is, and let's remember, he's lost all of his children. It really is a most difficult situation, yet he blesses God. And then in chapter 2, shall we indeed accept good from God and shall not accept adversity? In other words, he's acknowledging the fact that God has the right to do as he wishes, and Job has no cause of complaint. You've given me, you've blessed me, I have all these children, just as you have given me, so you have the right to also take away. I didn't deserve these things to begin with. And if you so see fit, you can take them away. And here in our text, in chapter 13 and verse 15, though he slay me, look at what Job says, yet will I trust him. Some translations say, I will hope in him. Others say, I will wait on him. Really, it doesn't make any difference. They're saying the same thing. Those who wait upon the Lord and put their hope and their trust in him do not do so in vain. They will not be disappointed. He is always worthy of our worship and our devotion and adoration. And when we take that line, it does not lead to futility or disappointment. I want to give some thought to this. In what sense did Job trust God? Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. In what sense did he trust God? We know the outcome to the book. We know that in the end, Job was vindicated in the face of his friends. Job ended up being more prosperous than what he was at the beginning. And we know that, but he didn't know that. He wasn't trusting God that he'd end up with more children and more livestock and more houses and property. He wasn't trusting God to be physically healed and blessed with more earthly goods. Job trusted God, believing that God would deliver on the promise of eternal things. That's evident right here in the passage that we're looking at, verse 16. He also shall be my salvation. You see, Job acknowledges that life might not always work out the way we would like, and his trust is in the Lord for better things to come. You see, mature faith understands that crooked providences will come into our lives, and some crooked providences will stay. Some crooked providences are made straight. You may go through a time of being very physically ill and having physical affliction, and you become better. The crooked providence is made straight. Your marriage might be on the rocks and very difficult, and there's a lot of tension, and you think you're on the verge of a divorce, and by God's grace there is healing in the relationship, and the crooked providence becomes straight. But not all crooked providences become straight, according to Ecclesiastes, Solomon in Ecclesiastes. There are some things that God does not straighten out, and mature faith understands that. Job understands that. Mature faith is confident of what awaits beyond this present world. Verse 16, he also shall be my salvation. Now the thing is, this is not an isolated statement. We see this fleshed out elsewhere in the book, this idea of Job looking ahead to better things. In chapter 14 is a wonderful chapter. It's one of the well-known chapters in the book, and there are a number of well-known chapters, and this is one of them. It's basically Job's ode to death. He says he makes some very memorable statements. Of course, the whole of the dialogue is recorded for us as poetry. It's actually poetic. And Job chapter 14 has made its way into the Anglican Book of Common Prayer. It's the graveside liturgy that Anglicans would traditionally use during funerals, and it's really appropriate to read it. It makes for very somber reading, actually. Man who is born of woman, born a few days, and born to trouble. And Job, in this ode to death, says, you know, we are like flowers that spring up and we die, and humanity is like a tree that's cut down. You know, we have our life and then we're cut down. But it's very interesting in the pictures that he uses, and especially with regards to the tree being cut down. It's like the roots of the stump die, but the tree itself, given the right conditions and moisture comes upon it, actually begins to shoot with new life, and Job points this out. And there's a little hint there in that language of something beyond death. Our lives are cut down like a tree cut down, but death is not the end. New life for God's people will come. Note what he says is, this is chapter 14, note what he says in verses 13 and 14. Oh, that you would hide me in the grave, that you would conceal me until your wrath is past, that you would appoint me a set time and remember me. If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my hard service I will wait. Note this, till my change comes. Job is effectively saying, what a good thing it would be if I was in the grave and this trouble could pass over me. If you would put me into the grave and there I would wait. But don't forget me, Lord. On the appointed day, waken me up, as it were. Remember me. Don't forget me. And then my change will come. Then my change will come. When he asks the question, if a man dies, shall he live again? It's rhetorical. All the days of my hard service I will wait till my change comes. What change is he referring to? He's referring to newness of life beyond this world. What about the famous verses or well-known verses in chapter 19, verses 25 to 27? Job says, for I know that my Redeemer lives and he shall stand at last on the earth. And after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold and not another, how my heart yearns within me. Now some of the scholars say we read too much of our New Testament theology into this, and that may very well be the case. We may suppose that Job understands more than what he actually does. Nevertheless, we still have to say, Job knew that there was more beyond this life. He was looking forward to a time when he would be vindicated before his friends. A time when he would see his Redeemer on the earth. Job most certainly believed in better things to come. We know that's the case anyway because he offers sacrifices for sin. He believes in salvation. He believes in deliverance from an eternal judgment. So faith trusts God for present help and blessings, no doubt. But that's only one dimension to faith. That's a limited dimension to faith. Faith connects us to that world which is yet to come. It sees into those future unseen realities. Hebrews chapter 1 verse 11. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. That verse is sometimes described as a definition of faith. It's not a definition of faith. It's a description of what faith does. What does faith do? It gives substance to things that we cannot see. It makes real to us things which lie beyond this world. Things that we can't handle or observe. things that we believe even though they are not around us. They lie in the future in the unseen realm. We can't see heaven. We can't see a new created order. We can't see the new Jerusalem, the resurrected body. We can't see any of these things. But faith gives substance to them. Do you know, in the eyes of the world, we believe things which are absolutely ridiculous, madness. The recreation of the earth, the resurrection of the body, a new heavens, new Jerusalem. All of these things are crazy in the eyes of unbelievers. But you and I live for these things because we have faith. Our faith gives substance to them. This is Job. In Hebrews 11 verses 8 to 10, we're told of Abraham by faith. Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. Note this, speaking of Abraham, for he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Abraham knew that the promised land pointed to something else. It was not about just soil and the Jews having their little plot of land, their little geographical area. Abraham knew that that land pointed to a greater reality. We've been learning about that reality in the book of Revelation, the New Jerusalem. A city whose architect is God. His builder and maker is God, that city which is to come. Let me ask the question then this evening, what does our faith look like in times of pain? Of course, we all see the Lord's hand in the blessings that we receive. We're all happy when life is good and everything is falling into place and we acknowledge God's goodness and his wisdom, his power and his love. Do we see the Lord's hand in the afflictions that we receive? How do we respond? Do we find ourselves in the company of Job or in the company of Job's wife? Now, all faith is faith. And, you know, perhaps Job's wife did have faith. And I believe she probably was a believer. But not all faith is of the same quality. Job is a picture of one kind of quality of faith and his wife another kind of quality of faith. No faith is perfect. But strong, healthy, growing faith is what we should desire for ourselves. And Job has this kind of faith. When affliction comes into his life, he does not keel over in a heap, unlike his wife. He is able to stand sure upon what he believes. And if we are to have a mature, healthy, growing faith, it means that we need to put down deep roots into the truth. And I don't think it's a nasty or cruel thing to say that there are many in the Christian church who have a very superficial understanding of the book that they claim to believe. We must put down deep roots into the truth. Why are some Christians so easily discouraged and so easily buffeted? And you know the reality is, and I don't mean this in a nasty way in any sense, and as an old pastor said to me some time ago, a man I greatly respect who's still preaching, he's nearly 80, he said to me, you know, a lot of Christians do not handle adversity well. It doesn't take much for them to crumple and to fold, much like Job's wife. As I say, I'm not asking this in a harsh or accusatory way. We must care for anyone who struggles. Weak faith is still faith, and we are to care for all people. But the reality is this. Some people struggle a lot through life due to shallow faith, and shallow faith equates to faith that has very little substance, has very little in terms of its grounding in the Word of God. Strong faith touches on many areas in the Christian life, but certainly it relates to the content of our knowledge, our engagement with the truth. Look at Psalm 1. Psalm 1, it's like a gateway into the Psalms. It like captures really the substance of what the Psalms are like. That's the way we understand it. We're presented with two people in the Psalms. There's always twos in the Bible. There's two gates. There's two paths. There's two kinds of foundations. There's two people in Psalm 1. There's the man who meditates upon the word day and night, and he is likened to a tree planted by water, and it brings forth its fruit in season. In Jeremiah chapter 17, we're presented with the same image, only the image is the tree bears fruit even during times of drought. Why? Because it has deep roots. What is the tree with deep roots? It's the person who meditates upon the word and applies the word. What about that tree that shrivels up and it's like chaff that the wind blows away? It has no depth of root, and it relates to the person who has no depth of understanding. They do not meditate upon the word and apply its lessons. You know, in one sense, faith is a difficult thing. According to Christian faith, you ought to believe in the creation of the world, out of nothing, God speaking. You ought to believe in the virgin birth, the incarnation, the miracles of this man called Jesus. You ought to believe in his death, his resurrection, his ascension, that he is at the right hand of God. You are to believe in your own future resurrection and a future judgment where people will end up in a new heavens and a new earth, or in a place of damnation. You are to believe all of these things, and in a certain sense they're hard to believe. We don't have any proof for any of this. The evidence that we have is in the scriptures. And if we're not grounded in the word of God, then how will we have strong faith to believe these things which support us through difficult times and enable us to see beyond our afflictions into that world which is to come? You know what? Faith doesn't just take care of itself. It's like health. I don't live the healthiest kind of lifestyle, and that has consequences for me. And I've been saying it for years, I need to improve, but health does not take care of itself. You need to get healthy, right? You need to exercise. You need to eat the right things. You need to address the issues that you have. And it's the same thing with faith. Faith does not just grow on its own. You don't just end up with healthy, strong, mature, growing faith. You have to pursue those things through prayer and through the word. Otherwise, you will forever remain immature. Your faith might be real, but it can be weak. It can be immature. It can be buffeted at the slightest thing. Faith needs to be nurtured, and it needs to be strengthened, and it needs to be cultivated, like a plant being fertilized and being watered and receiving sunlight. Let me say to you all, don't wait until the difficult days come and you find yourself without spiritual reservoir upon which you can draw. What we ought to be doing is growing our faith in the good times. So when the bad times come, we're actually prepared. It's like preparing a vessel for when the storms come at sea. It's made seaworthy, it's nice and strong, it's able to take the buffeting of the waves and the wind. And so it is with us. So many Christians find themselves in bad situations, and all of a sudden now they need to call upon the Lord and find some kind of hope somewhere from something in his word, rather than almost having a reservoir, a spiritual reservoir upon which they can draw, because they've already spent years in the word. They know the word. They know the Lord. Trees with deep roots survive storms and droughts. And not only survive, they produce fruit. All right. So that's my first point then this evening. Job, a picture of mature faith. I want to note, secondly, Job, a picture of a good conscience. Verses 15 and 16, or the second part of verse 15 and into verse 16. I will defend my own ways before him. He also shall be my salvation. For a hypocrite could not come before him. Let me just provide for you the flow of thought, and I'm going to do so just by paraphrasing these verses in the context. If we go back and read through the chapter, what we find is that Job says to his friends that he's going to address God. He's going to actually speak directly to God. In verse 13, he tells his friends to be quiet. He's going to speak to God. In verse 14, he says that in doing this, he's basically going to take his life into his own hands. He's going to come before God and make this appeal, and that is a precarious thing to do. Even in an earthly sense, you can't march into the presence of the king and just make demands and try and vindicate yourself and, you know, bring your appeal. You can only make your way into the presence of the king by way of invitation. Let us understand that this is not the new covenant like we have today and the confidence we have in Christ Jesus. Okay, this is before the sacrificial system and all of that is established as well with Israel. And so Job acknowledges that to come before God in this manner, okay, is to take his life into his own hands. Verse 14, then comes the famous affirmation, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. And he's basically saying, I've experienced the pain of what God can do, yet I will trust him nevertheless with my eternal welfare because he is trustworthy. And he continues in verse 15. He says, I will defend my own ways before him. In other words, I will plead my cause before him. Verse 16, he is my salvation. I am confident because I am not a hypocrite. And it's interesting to gather the whole flow of thought. Job acknowledges the fact that he's a sinful man. He knows that he's not perfect. Yet at the same time, he believes that God will be tolerant to his appeals. Job is not perfect. He is sinful, but he has lived a repentant life. He offers sacrifices to God. He trusts in God's character and he is sure that God will not wipe him out. But even if God does wipe him out, if God does take his life, he has the assurance that he will be delivered from eternal destruction. Maybe God will snuff out his life in this world. But he trusts God for salvation. He believes that he is eternally secure. Job will emerge in the eternal state, a new and better man. But what I want to do here with this second point is I want to pick up on this statement of Job's. From verse 16, a hypocrite could not stand before him. A hypocrite cannot come before God and expect to be received. I want to make the point that you can't have healthy, mature faith, growing faith, if you don't have a good conscience. Job has a good conscience. He knows he is not a hypocrite. And just so there's no misunderstanding when we think of what a good conscience is not self-righteousness. It's not feeling pleased with ourselves. A good conscience relates to sincerity in the things of God. A good conscience is to know that we genuinely desire righteousness in our lives. We don't behave one way in front of other people and another way when we are on our own. A good conscience is a clear conscience. It means that we are not carrying around the baggage of deception and duplicity. Mature faith recoils at the idea of hypocrisy. Mature faith loves godliness and it outworks itself with integrity. And the scriptures speak to us frequently about the necessity, the absolute centrality and necessity of living before God and before man with a good conscience. It's all a part of what makes faith healthy. I want to note a couple of verses in 1 Timothy chapter 1. With regards to this idea of a good conscience. To begin with, 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 5. Now, the purpose of the commandment is love from a pure heart, from a good conscience, and from sincere faith. And Paul here, if we go through the context, Paul is dealing with the issue of false teaching and false teachers. He's contrasting true biblical preaching with what they do. Now, false teachers, of course, are seeking to serve themselves. They want to draw followers to themselves. They want to build their reputations. They're interested in personal gain, whether it be money or whatever. But what is true biblical preaching concerned with? It's concerned with love. Now, the purpose of the commandment is love. Look at what he says. From a pure heart, from a good conscience, and from sincere faith. The goal of the word, explained is that we would love God and love one another from a pure heart. In other words, love from within, not in show only, not just externally, but in reality from within, from a good conscience, In other words, no selfishness involved. We're not just showing love to God in the assembly or love to one another because it suits us, because it's going to get us somewhere. No. We're not feigning self-love. No, there is a genuine care and concern for the things of God and for one another. And then from sincere faith, in other words, love grounded in truth, not sentimental dribble, but true biblical love. So when we think of a good conscience, it's absolutely at the heart of what is necessary for healthy Christian living. To know that we are walking with God in sincerity, with integrity, with honesty, that we're not just putting up some kind of front because it's expected or because we might get something from it. You can't worship God properly apart from a good conscience. The fact that you know deep down you are sincere, you do love him and you do love God's people. That's what we find with Job. There was no hypocrisy in Job. Job was a righteous man. He loved the Lord and he loved God's people. You notice here how a good conscience goes with faith. From a good conscience, from sincere, and from sincere faith. Love from a good conscience and from sincere faith. Note also 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 18 and 19. This charge I commit to you, son Timothy, according to the prophecies previously made concerning you, that by them you may wage the good warfare, having faith and a good conscience, which some have rejected concerning the faith, have suffered shipwreck. So Paul is urging Timothy to take up the ministry with earnestness and to fight the good fight against error with faith and a good conscience. Having faith here means trusting God, being faithful to the truth, not cutting corners. Sticking to God's word and his purpose. A good conscience means that you're not ministering for personal gain. You're not doing it to get anything out of it, to build reputation or to make money or to gain followers or anything like that. You're doing it sincerely for the glory of God and for the good of God's people and to see people saved. Now, Paul frequently says that he ministers out of a good conscience. In other words, he can stand before congregations and he can preach the truth. And he can do so knowing he's not doing it to get money. He's not trying to gain a reputation or a following. He's simply seeking to see the church built up, people saved and God's name glorified. We see in these passages that faith and good faith, or healthy faith and a good conscience, go together. That's what we see with Job, mature faith and a good conscience. See, when it comes to Job, he lived before God with integrity. He lived by what he understood. We don't know everything that Job understood. It's such early days in terms of salvific history and knowledge. We don't know how much he understood. But he knew he was sinful. He knew what sin was. He understood God and God's holiness and judgment and eternal life. And he lived in the knowledge of this. He lived by what he understood. Job's faith was no theoretical faith. He practiced righteousness from the heart. He was no hypocrite, as his friends accused him of. And if we fall into hypocrisy, if we fall into the habit of just putting up a front because we're before other people, then we not only run the risk of having a stunted, immature, shallow faith, we actually run the risk of shipwrecking our faith. And so we have Job accused of hypocrisy. This runs throughout the discourse with his friends. Yet he demonstrated exactly the opposite. The storms hit, and severe storms, unimaginable storms. And that deep-rooted faith held secure. The years spent pursuing the truth and practicing the truth sustained him when everything else was going wrong. You stop and put yourself in his shoes. He's lost everything. All of his children are dead. Forget the financial loss, property and livestock. His 10 children are dead. His friends have turned on him. His own wife has turned on him. Yet he stands firm in his belief, absolutely rock solid in his belief. If we do not practice the truth, we do not seek out the truth and practice the truth will not sustain us. And our hypocrisy will prove to be our undoing. Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 1, among other sins, put away this sin, put away that sin, put away hypocrisy. Be done with it. Be done with the idea that Christianity is just a show. It's something you just perform when you're in front of other people. Be done away with that notion. You're not only deceiving others, you're ultimately deceiving yourself. Live before God with sincerity and integrity in the secret place. You are only as good as what you are in private. The real you is in private when the doors are shut and the blinds are closed and nobody's around, or you're in front of perhaps certain people. That's the real you, not when you're in front of Christians. Live before God with sincerity and integrity, in other words, with a good conscience. So just to conclude then this evening, there are two important realities in Job's confession from chapter 13, verses 15 and 16. Though he slay me, yet I will trust him. Whatever befalls me, whatever God sees fit to bring into my life, I will worship him. I will trust him with my eternal welfare. He may very well afflict me and afflict me severely, and it is his right to do so. Yet I will continue to trust him for those unseen realities which are yet to come. And I can trust him, and you should be able to trust him with those unseen realities, because we have a faith which is rooted deeply in his word. And then secondly, he also shall be my salvation, for a hypocrite could not come before him. I know he will receive me. And this ought to be our confession. Because although I am far from perfect, yet I've believed the truth concerning him and sought to live accordingly to that truth. I may have my faults and my sins, yet I am no hypocrite. I have believed and I've sought to live righteously. In good conscience, I can say, I trust Christ, I love Christ, and I've sought to honour him. Within the context of my failings, I have lived repentantly. These are the confessions that we must be able to make about ourselves. These are Job's confessions. May the Lord enable us all to have them as our own confessions. Amen.